This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Widow by Fiona Barton. Read for you by Hannah Curtis, Nicholas Guy Smith, and Mandy Williams, with Jane Entwistle and Steve West. Chapter 1. The Widow. Wednesday, June 9th, 2010. I can hear the sound of her crunching up the path, heavy-footed in high heels. She's almost at the door, hesitating and smoothing her hair out of her face. Nice outfit. Jacket with big buttons. Decent dress underneath. And glasses perched on her head. Not a Jehovah's Witness or from the Labour Party. Must be a reporter. But not the usual. She's my second one today. Fourth this week. And it's only Wednesday. I bet she says, "I'm sorry to bother you at such a difficult time." They all say that and put on that stupid face, like they care. I'm going to wait to see if she rings twice. The man this morning didn't. Some are obviously bored to death with trying. They leave as soon as they take their finger off the bell, marching back down the path as fast as they can, into their cars and away. They can tell their bosses they knocked on the door, but I wasn't there. Pathetic. She rings twice, then knocks loudly in that rap-rap-rappity-rap way like a policeman. She sees me looking through the gap at the side of my sheer curtains and smiles this big smile. A Hollywood smile, my mum used to say. Then she knocks again. When I open the door, she hands me the bottle of milk from the doorstep and says, "You don't want to leave that out. It'll spoil. Shall I come in? Have you got the kettle on?" I can't breathe, let alone speak. She smiles again, head on one side. "I'm Kate," she says. "Kate Waters, a reporter from the Daily Post." I start, suddenly realizing she hasn't asked. "I know who you are, Mrs. Taylor," she says. Unspoken are the words. "You are the story." "Let's not stand out here," she says. And as she talks, somehow she's come in. I feel too stunned by the turn of events to speak, and she takes my silence as permission to go into the kitchen with a bottle of milk and make me a cup of tea. I follow her in. It's not a big kitchen, and we're in a bit of a squeeze as she bustles about, filling the kettle and opening all my cupboards, looking for cups and sugar. I just stand there, letting it all happen. She's chatting about the kitchen. "What a lovely, fresh-looking room. I wish mine looked like this. Did you put a new kitchen in?" It feels like I'm talking to a friend. It isn't how I thought it would be, talking to a reporter. I thought it would be like being questioned by the police. Thought it would be an ordeal. An interrogation. That's what my husband, Glenn, said. But it isn't somehow. I say, "Yes, we chose white doors and red handles because it looked so clean." I'm standing in my house discussing kitchens with a reporter. Glenn would have had a fit. She says, "Through here, is it?" And I open the door to the living room. I'm not sure if I want her here or not. Not sure how I feel. It doesn't feel right to protest now. She's just sitting and chatting with a cup of tea in her hand. It's funny. I'm quite enjoying the attention. I get a bit lonely inside this house now that Glenn is gone. And she seems to be in charge of things. It's quite nice, really, to have someone in charge of me again. I was beginning to panic that I'd have to cope with everything on my own. But Kate Waters is saying she'll sort everything out. "All I have to do is tell her about my life," she says. My life. She doesn't really want to know about me. She hasn't walked up my path to hear about Jean Taylor. She wants to know the truth about him. About Glenn, my husband. You see, my husband died last week. Knocked down by a bus just outside Sainsbury's. He was there one minute, giving me grief about what sort of cereal I should have bought. And the next, dead on the road. Head injuries, they said. dead anyway. I just stood there and looked at him, lying there. People were running around, finding blankets, and there was a bit of blood on the pavement. Not much blood, though. He would have been glad. He didn't like any sort of mess. Everyone was very kind and trying to stop me from seeing his body. But I couldn't tell them I was glad he was gone. No more of his nonsense. Chapter 2. The Widow. Wednesday, June 9th, 2010. The police came to the hospital, of course. Even D.I. Bob Sparks turned up at the accident and emergency department to talk about Glenn. I said nothing to him or any of the others. Told them there was nothing to say. I was too upset to talk. Cried a bit. D.I. Bob Sparks has been a part of my life for so long. More than 3 years it is now. But I think perhaps he will disappear with you, Glenn. I don't say any of this to Kate Waters. She is in the other armchair in the sitting room, nursing her mug of tea and jiggling her foot. Jean, she says. No more Mrs. Taylor, I notice. This last week must have been terrible for you. And after all you've already been through. I say nothing, just stare at my lap. She has no idea what I've been through. No one has really. I've never been able to tell anyone. Glenn said that was best. We wait in silence, and then she tries a different tack. She stands up and picks up a photo of us from the mantelpiece, both of us laughing at something. You look so young, she says. Was this before you got married? I nod. Did you know each other a long time before that? Did you meet at school? No, not at school. We met at a bus stop, I tell her. He was very good-looking and he made me laugh. I was 17, an apprentice at a hairdresser's in Greenwich, and he worked in a bank. He was a bit older and wore a suit and good shoes. He was different. I'm making it sound like some romantic novel, and Kate Waters is lapping it up, scribbling in her notebook, peering at me over those little glasses and nodding as if she understands. She isn't fooling me. Actually, Glenn didn't seem the romantic sort at first. Our courtship was mainly in the dark, the cinema, the back seat of his escort, the park, and there wasn't much time for talking. But I remember the first time he told me he loved me. I prickled all over, like I could feel every inch of my skin. I felt alive for the first time in my life. I told him I loved him too, desperately, that I couldn't eat or sleep for thinking about him. My mum said it was a fascination on my part when I mooned around the house. I wasn't sure what it meant, fascination. But I wanted to be with Glenn all the time. And back then he said he felt the same. I think Mum was a bit jealous. She relied on me. She relies on you too much, Jeannie, Glenn said. Not healthy to be going everywhere with your daughter. I tried to explain about Mum being frightened of going out on her own, but Glenn said she was being selfish. He was so protective, picking a seat for me in the pub away from the bar. Don't want it to be too noisy for you. And ordering for me at restaurants so I tasted new things. You'll love this, Jeannie. Just try it. So I did. And sometimes the new things were lovely. And if they weren't, I didn't say anything in case I hurt his feelings. He would go quiet if I went against him. I hated that. Felt I'd disappointed him. I'd never been out with someone like Glenn. Someone who knew what they wanted in life. The other boys were just that. Boys. 2 years later, when Glenn proposed, he didn't go down on one knee. He held me very close and said, "You belong to me, Jeannie. We belong together. Let's get married." He'd won Mum over by then, anyway. He'd come with flowers. A little something for the other woman in my life, he'd say to make her giggle. And he'd talk to her about Coronation Street or the royal family, and Mum loved it. She said I was a lucky girl, that he'd brought me out of myself, would make something of me. She could see he'd take care of me. And he did. What was he like then? Kate Waters asks, leaning forward to encourage me. Then. She means before all the bad stuff. Oh, he was a lovely man. Very lovey-dovey. Couldn't do enough for me, I say. Always bringing me flowers and presents. Said I was the one. I was blown over by it all. I was only 17. She loves it. Writes it all down in a funny scrawl and looks up. I'm trying not to laugh. I feel the hysteria rising, but it comes out like a sob, and she reaches her hand over to touch my arm. Don't be upset, she says. It's all over now. And it is. No more police, no more Glenn, no more of his nonsense. I can't quite remember when I started calling it that. It had begun long before I could name it. I was too busy making our marriage perfect, beginning with the wedding at Charlton House. My mum and dad thought I was too young at 19, but we persuaded them. Well, Glenn did, really. He was so determined, so devoted to me. And in the end, Dad said yes, and we celebrated with a bottle of Lambrusco. They paid a fortune for the wedding because I was their only one, and I spent my whole time looking at pictures in bridal magazines with Mum and dreaming of my big day. My big day. How I clung to that and filled my life with it. Glenn never interfered. That's your department, he'd say and laugh. He made it sound like he had a department too. I thought it was probably his job. He was the main breadwinner, he said. I know it sounds old-fashioned, Jeannie, but I want to look after you. You're still very young, and we've got everything in front of us. He always had big ideas, and they sounded so exciting when he talked about them. He was going to be the manager of the branch, then leave to start his own business, be his own boss, and make lots of money. I could see him in a posh suit with a secretary and a big car. And me, I was going to be there for him. Never change, Jeannie. I love you just the way you are, he'd say. So we bought number 12 and moved in after the wedding. We're still here all those years later. The house had a front garden, but we gravelled over. To save on cutting the grass, Glenn said. I quite liked the grass, but Glenn liked things neat. It was hard in the beginning when we first moved in together, because I was always a bit untidy. Mum was always finding dirty plates and odd socks in the fluff under my bed at home. Glenn would have died if he'd looked. I can see him now, clenching his teeth, and his eyes going all narrow when he caught me brushing crumbs off the table onto the floor with my hand after we'd had tea one night, early on. Didn't even know I was doing it. Must have done it 100 times without thinking, but I never did it again. He was good for me in that way. Taught me how to do things right, so the house was nice. He liked it nice. In the early days, Glenn told me all about his job in the bank, the responsibilities he had, how the juniors relied on him, the jokes the staff played on one another, the boss he couldn't stand. Thinks he's better than everyone, Jeannie. And the people he worked with, Joy and Liz in the back office. Scott, one of the counter staff, who had terrible skin and blushed over everything. May, the trainee who kept making mistakes. I loved listening to him. Loved hearing about his world. I suppose I did tell him about my work, but we seemed to drift back to the bank quite quickly. Hairdressing isn't the most exciting job, he'd say, but you do it very well, Jeannie. I'm very proud of you. He was trying to make me feel better about myself, he told me, and he did. It felt so safe, being loved by Glenn. Kate Waters is looking at me, doing that thing with her head again. She's good, I'll give her that. I've never spoken to a journalist before, apart from telling them to go away. Never mind let one in the house. They've been coming to the door for years on and off, and no one has got inside until today. Glenn saw to that. but he's not here now. And Kate Waters seems different. She's told me she feels a real connection with me. Says she feels like we've known each other for ages. And I know what she means. His death must have come as a terrible shock, she says, giving my arm another squeeze. I nod dumbly. I can't tell her how I started lying awake, wishing Glenn were dead. Well, not dead, exactly. I didn't want him to be in any pain or suffer or anything. I just wanted him not to be there anymore. I would fantasize about the moment when I'd get the call from a police officer. Mrs. Taylor, the deep voice would say, I'm so sorry, but I've got bad news. The anticipation of the next bit used to make me almost giggle. Mrs. Taylor, I'm afraid your husband has been killed in an accident. I then saw myself, really saw myself, sobbing and picking up the phone to ring his mom and tell her, Mary, I'd say, I'm so sorry. I've got some bad news. It's Glenn. He's dead. I can hear the shock in her gasp. I can feel her grief. I can feel the sympathy of friends at my loss, gathering my family around me. Then the secret thrill. Me, the grieving widow. Don't make me laugh. Of course, when it really happened, it didn't feel nearly as real. For a moment, his mum sounded almost as relieved as me that it was all over. Then she put the phone down, weeping for her boy. And there were no friends to tell, and just a handful of family to gather around me. Kate Waters chirps up about needing the loo and making another cup of tea, and I let her get on with it, giving her my mug and showing her the downstairs bathroom. When she's gone, I look around the room quickly, making sure there's nothing of Glenn's out. No souvenirs for her to steal. Glenn warned me. He told me stories about the press. I hear the toilet flush, and she eventually reappears with a tray and starts again about what a remarkable woman I must be. So loyal. I keep looking at the wedding picture on the wall above the gas fire. We look so young. We could have been dressing up in our parents' clothes. Kate Waters sees me looking and stands to take the photo off the wall. She perches on the arm of my chair and we look at it together. September 6, 1989, the day we tied the knot. I don't know why, but I start to cry. My first real tears since Glenn died. Kate Waters puts an arm around me.
Chapter 3. The Reporter. Wednesday, June 9th, 2010. Kate Waters shifted in her chair. She shouldn't have had that cup of coffee earlier. What with that and the tea, her bladder was sending distress signals and she might have to leave Jean Taylor alone with her thoughts. Not a good idea at this stage of the game, especially as Jean had gone a bit quiet, sipping her tea and gazing into the distance. Kate was desperate not to pause the moment and damage the rapport she was building with her. They were at a very delicate stage. Lose eye contact and the whole mood could change. Her husband, Steve, had once compared her job to stalking an animal. He'd had a glass too many of Rioja and was showing off at a dinner party. She gets closer and closer, feeding them little bits of kindness and humor, a hint of money to come, their chance to give their side of the story, until they are eating out of the palm of her hand. It's a real art, he'd told the guests around their dining room table. They were his colleagues from the oncology department, and Kate had sat doing her professional smile and murmuring, Come on, darling, you know me better than that, as the guests laughed nervously and sipped their wine. She'd been furious during the washing up, sloshing the suds over the floor as she threw pans into the sink, but Steve had put his arms around her and kissed her into a reconciliation. You know how much I admire you, Katie, he'd said. You're brilliant at what you do. She'd kissed him back, but he was right. It was sometimes a game or a flirtatious dance to make an instant connection with a suspicious, even hostile stranger. She loved it. Loved the adrenaline rush of getting to the doorstep first, ahead of the pack, ringing the bell and hearing the sounds of life inside the house, seeing the light change in the frosted glass as the person approached and then, as the door opened, going into full performance mode. Reporters had different techniques on the doorstep. One friend she'd trained with called it his last puppy in the basket look to get sympathy. Another always blamed her news editor for making her knock on the door again. And one had once stuffed a pillow up her jumper to pretend she was pregnant and asked to use the loo to get in. Not Kate style. She had her own rules. Always smile. Never stand too close to the door. Don't start with an apology. And try to distract from the fact that you're after a story. She'd used the bottle of milk thing before, but milkmen were a dying breed. She was very pleased with herself for getting through this door with such apparent ease. In truth, she hadn't wanted to come in the first place. She needed to go into the office to finish her expenses forms before her credit card bill came through and cleaned out her bank account, but her news editor was having none of it.
"Go and knock on the widow's door. It's on your way in," Terry Deacon shouted down the phone above the radio news headlines blaring out beside him. "Never know. Today might be your lucky day."
Kate had sighed. She knew immediately who Terry meant. There was only one widow everyone wanted to interview that week, but she also knew it was a well-trodden path. Three of her colleagues at the Post had already tried, and she was sure she must be the last reporter in the country to knock on this particular door. Almost. As she reached the turn onto Jean Taylor's road, she automatically checked for other press and immediately spotted the man from The Times standing by a car. Boring tie, elbow patches, and a side part. Classic. She edged her car forward as the traffic crawled along the main road, but kept one eye on the enemy. She'd have to go around the block again and hope he'd gone by the time she got back. "Bloody hell," she muttered, signalling left and swinging down a side street to park. 15 minutes and a flick through the dailies later, Kate put her seatbelt back on and restarted the car. Her phone rang, and she dug deep into her bag to find it. Fishing it out, she saw Bob Sparks's name on the display and turned off the engine.
"Hello, Bob. How are you? What's happening?"
Detective Inspector Bob Sparks wanted something, that was obvious. He wasn't the sort of bloke to ring for a chat, and she bet herself the call would last less than 60 seconds.
"Hi, Kate. Good, thanks. Quite busy. You know what it's like. Got a couple of cases on the go, but nothing interesting." "Look, Kate, just wondered if you were still working on the Glenn Taylor case."
"Christ, Bob, have you got me on CCTV or something? I'm just about to go and knock on Jean Taylor's door."
Sparks laughed. "Don't worry, you're not on the surveillance list as far as I know."
"Anything I should know before I see her?" Kate asked. "Anything new since Glenn Taylor died?"
"No, not really." She could hear the disappointment in his voice. "Wondered if you'd heard anything. Anyway, I'd appreciate a heads up if Jean says anything."
"I'll give you a call afterward," she said. "But she'll probably slam the door in my face. That's what she's done to all the rest of the reporters."
"Okay, speak later."
End of. She looked at the phone and smiled. 41 seconds. A new record. She must tease him about it next time she saw him. 5 minutes later, she'd cruised down the Taylor's newly media-free street and walked up the path. Now, she needed the story.
"Oh, for God's sake, how can I concentrate?" she thought, digging her nails into her hands to distract herself.
No, no good.
"Sorry, Jean, but would it be all right to use your loo?" she said, smiling apologetically. "Tea. It goes straight through, doesn't it? I'll make us another drink if you like."
Jean nodded and rose from her seat to guide the way.
"It's through here," she said,
standing aside so Kate could edge past into the peachy haven of the downstairs loo. Washing her hands with the perfumed guest soap, Kate looked up and caught her expression in the mirror. She looked a bit tired, she thought, smoothing her unruly hair down and tapping the bags under her eyes with her fingertips, as instructed by the girl who did her occasional facials. In the kitchen on her own, she idly read the notes and magnets on the fridge while she waited for the kettle to boil. Shopping lists and holiday souvenirs, nothing much for her here. A photo of the Taylors taken in a beach restaurant showed the couple smiling and raising their glasses to the camera. Glenn Taylor, all tousled dark hair and holiday smile, and Jean, dark blonde hair, done for the occasion and tucked neatly behind her ears, going out makeup slightly smudged by the heat and that sideways glance at her husband. Adoring or in awe? Kate wondered. The last couple of years had clearly taken their toll on the woman in the photo. Jean was sitting waiting for her in cargo pants, baggy t-shirt and cardigan, her hair escaping from a stubby ponytail. Steve was always teasing her about how she noticed the little things, but it was part of the job. "I'm a trained observer," she'd joked, and delighted in pointing out tiny, telling details. She'd immediately spotted the damage to Jean's rough and cracked hands, hairdresser's hands, she thought to herself, and the skin around the nails, frayed from the widow's nervous chewing. The lines around her eyes told their own story. Kate took her phone out and photographed the picture. She noted that everything in the kitchen was immaculate, nothing like her own, where her teenage sons would no doubt have left a trail of detritus from their abandoned breakfast, stained coffee mugs, souring milk, half-eaten toast, a lidless jar of jam with a knife sticking out of it, and the obligatory filthy football kit festering on the floor. The kettle, and thoughts of home, clicked off, and she made the tea and carried the mugs through on a tray. Jean was staring into space, her teeth working on her thumb. "That's better," Kate said, plonking herself down. "Sorry about that. Now, where were we?" She had to admit she was beginning to worry. She'd spent nearly an hour with Jean Taylor and had a notebook full of bits and pieces about her childhood, early married life, but that was all. Every time she edged a bit closer to the story, Jean would change the subject to something safe. They'd had a long discussion about the challenges of bringing up kids at one point, and then there had been a brief interlude when Kate had finally taken one of the insistent calls from the office. Terry was beside himself when he heard where Kate was. "Brilliant!" he yelled down the phone. "Well done! What's she saying? When can you file?" Under the widow's watchful eyes, Kate muttered, "Hang on a minute, Terry, the reception isn't very good here," and slipped into the back garden, signalling mock irritation to Jean with a weary shake of her head. "For God's sake, Terry, I was sitting next to her. I can't really talk now," she hissed. "It's a bit slow, to be honest, but I think she's beginning to trust me. Let me get on with it." "Have you got her under contract yet?" Terry asked. "Get her under contract, and then we can take our time getting the full works." "I don't want to scare her off by pushing things, Terry. I'll do my level best. Speak later." Kate pressed the off button on the phone with feeling and considered her next move. Maybe she just needed to mention the money straight away. She'd done the tea and sympathy, and now she had to stop dancing around the edge. After all, Jean might be hard up now that her husband was dead. He wasn't there to provide for her anymore. Or to stop her from talking.
Chapter 4. The Widow. Wednesday, June 9th, 2010. She's still here. An hour later. Before today, I'd have asked her to go. I've never had a problem before telling the press people to get lost when they knock. Easy when they are so rude. "Hello," they say, then straight into their questions. Horrible, intrusive questions. Kate Waters hasn't asked anything hard. Yet. We've talked about all sorts of things. When Glenn and I bought, the price of property around here, what we've done to it, the price of paint, the neighbourhood, where I grew up and where I went to school, that sort of thing. She chimes in with everything I say. Oh, I went to a school like that. I hated the teachers, didn't you? That kind of thing. Makes me feel I'm chatting to a friend. That she's just like me. Clever, really. But maybe it's what she does every time she does an interview. She's not so bad, really. I think I could quite like her. She's funny and seems kind. But maybe it's all an act. She's telling me about her husband, her old man, as she calls him, and how she must give him a ring later to let him know she might be home late. Not sure why she'll be late. It isn't even lunchtime yet, and she lives only 30 minutes around the South Circular. But I tell her she needs to ring straight away, or he'll worry. Glenn would have worried. He'd have given me hell if I stayed out without telling him. "It's not fair on me, Jeannie," he'd have said. But I don't tell her that. Kate is laughing and says her old man is used to it now. But he will complain, because he'll have to deal with the kids. She's got teenagers, she tells me. Jake and Freddie, with no manners and no respect. He'll have to cook dinner, she says. But I bet he orders a pizza. The boys'll love that. The boys are driving her and the old man mad, apparently, because they won't clean up their bedrooms. They're living in a pigsty, Jean, she says. You won't believe how many cereal bowls I found in Jake's room. Practically a dinner service. And they lose socks every week. Our house is like the Bermuda Triangle of footwear. And she laughs again, because she loves them, pigsty or not. All I can think is, Jake and Freddie. What lovely names. I stash them away for later, for my collection. And I'm nodding like I understand how she feels. But I don't, do I? I'd have loved her problems. I'd have loved to have a teenager to nag. Anyway, I find myself saying out loud, Glenn could be a bit difficult when I let the house get in a mess. I just wanted to show her I had my own fair share of problems. That I was just like her. Stupid, really. How could I ever be just like her? Or anybody. Me. Glenn always said I was different. When we were going out, he'd show me off, telling his mates that I was special. I couldn't figure it out, really. I worked in a salon called Hair Today. Leslie's, the owner's little joke. And spent all my time shampooing and making cups of coffee for menopausal women. I thought hairdressing was going to be fun. Glamorous, even. Thought I'd be cutting hair and creating new styles. But at 17, I was bottom of the ladder. Jean, Leslie would call across to me, can you shampoo my lady and then sweep up around the chairs? No, please or thank you. The customers were all right. They liked telling me all their news and problems because I listened and didn't try to give them advice, like Leslie. I nodded and smiled and daydreamed while they rabbited on about their grandson and his glue sniffing, or the neighbour who was throwing her dog mess over the fence. Whole days would go past without me giving an opinion beyond, that's nice, or making up holiday plans to keep the conversation going. But I stuck at it. I did the courses, learning how to cut and colour, and started getting my own clients. It wasn't very well paid, but I wasn't really fit for anything else. Didn't work at school. Mum told people I was dyslexic, but the truth is, I couldn't be bothered. Then Glenn showed up, and I was suddenly special. Nothing much changed at work, but I didn't socialise with the three other girls because Glenn never liked me going out on my own. He said the other girls were single and out for sex and booze. He was probably right, if their Monday morning stories were anything to go by. But I just made excuses, and in the end, they stopped asking me. I used to enjoy my work because I could drift off into my head and there was no stress. It made me feel safe. The smells of chemicals and straightened hair, the sounds of chatter and running water, hairdryers roaring and the predictability of it all. The appointment book, marked up in blunt pencil, ruled my day. Everything was decided, even the uniform of black trousers and white tops, apart from Saturday, when we all had to wear jeans. Demeaning on a woman of your experience. You're a stylist, not a junior genie, Glenn had said later. Anyway, it meant I didn't have to decide what to wear, or do, most days. No grief. They all loved Glenn. He'd come and pick me up on a Saturday, and lean on the desk to talk to Leslie. He knew so much, my Glenn, all about the business side of things, and he could make people laugh, even when he was talking about serious stuff. He's so clever, your husband, Leslie would say, and so good-looking. You're a lucky girl, Jean. I always understood that she couldn't believe Glenn had chosen me. Sometimes I couldn't either. He would laugh if I said it, and pull me into him. You are everything I want, he'd say. He helped me see things for what they were. He helped me grow up, I suppose. I didn't know the first thing about money and running a home when we got married, so Glenn gave me housekeeping money each week and a notebook to write down everything I spent. Then we'd sit and he'd balance the figures. I learned so much from him. Kate is talking again, but I've missed the start. It's something about an arrangement, and she's talking about money. Sorry, I say, I was miles away for a minute. She smiles patiently and leans forward again. I know how difficult this is, Jean, having the press on your doorstep night and day. But honestly, the only way to get rid of them is to do an interview. Then they'll all lose interest and will leave you alone. I nod to show I'm listening, but she gets all excited, thinks I'm agreeing to it. Hang on, I say in a bit of a panic. I'm not saying yes or no. I need to think it through. We'd be happy to make a payment, to compensate you for your time, and to help you at this difficult time, she says quickly. Funny, isn't it? How they try to dress things up. Compensate. She means they'll pay me to spill the beans, but she doesn't want to risk offending me. I've had lots of offers over time, the sort of money you win on the lottery. You should see the letters that have been pushed through my letterbox by reporters. They'd make you blush, they're so false. Still, I suppose it's better than the hate mail that gets sent. Sometimes people tear out an article from the papers about Glenn and write monster in block capitals with lots of underlining. Sometimes they underline it so hard their pen goes through the page. Anyway, the reporters do the opposite, but they are just as sickening, really. Dear Mrs. Taylor, or just Jean sometimes, I hope you will not mind me writing to you at this difficult time, blah, blah, blah. So much has been written about you, but we would like to give you the chance to tell your side of the story, blah, blah, blah. Glenn used to read them out in one of his funny voices, and would laugh, and then I'd stick them in a drawer. But that was when he was still alive. There was no one to share this with. I look back down at my tea. It's cold now, and there's a bit of a skin on the top. It's that full-fat milk that Glenn insists on. Insisted. I can get low-fat milk now. I smile. Kate, who's doing her big sell on how sensitive and responsible her newspaper is, and God knows what else, sees the smile as another positive signal. She's offering to take me to a hotel for a couple of nights, to get away from the rest of the reporters and all that pressure, she says. To give you a break, Jean. I need a break, I think. As if on cue, there's a ring on the front doorbell. Kate peeps through the sheer curtains and hisses. Bloody hell, Jean, there's a bloke from the local TV station outside. Keep quiet and he'll go away. I do as I'm told, as usual. You see, she's taking over where Glenn left off. In charge, protecting me from the press outside. Except, of course, she's the press too. Oh God, I'm in here with the enemy. I turn to say something, but the bell goes again and the letterbox flap pings up. Mrs. Taylor, the voice shouts into the empty hall. Mrs. Taylor, it's Jim Wilson from Capital TV. I only want a minute of your time. Just a quick word. Are you there? Kate and I sit looking at each other. She's very tense. It's strange to see someone else, going through what I go through 2 or 3 times a day. I want to tell her that I've learned to just stay quiet. I even hold my breath sometimes, so they won't know there's a living soul in the house. But Kate can't sit still. Then she gets her mobile out. Are you going to phone a friend? I ask, trying to break the atmosphere. But of course the telly bloke hears me. Mrs. Taylor, I know you're there. Please come to the door. I promise I'll only take a moment. I just need to speak to you. We want to give you a platform. Kate suddenly shouts, fuck off! And I stare at her. Glenn would never have allowed a woman to say that word in his house. She looks at me and mouths, sorry, and then puts her finger to her lips. And the telly man does fuck off. Well, that obviously works, I say. Sorry, but it's the only language they understand, she says, and laughs. It is a nice laugh. Sounds genuine. And I haven't heard much laughter lately. Now then, let's sort out this hotel before another reporter comes. I just nod. The last time I went to a hotel was when Glenn and I went to Whitstable for a weekend, a few years ago now. Must have been 2004, for our 15th anniversary. A milestone, Jeannie, he'd said. It's longer than most armed robbers get. He liked a joke. Anyway, Whitstable was only an hour from home, but we stayed in a lovely place on the seafront and ate posh fish and chips and went walking along the stony beach. I picked up flat stones for Glenn, and he skimmed them through the waves, and we counted the skips together. There was the clanging of sails on the masts of the little boats, and the wind whipping my hair into a mess. But I think I was truly happy. Glenn didn't say much. He just wanted to walk, and I was happy to get some of his attention. You see, Glenn was disappearing from my life, really. He was there, but not there, if you know what I mean. The computer was more of a wife than I was, in all sorts of ways, as it turned out. He had a camera thing so people could see him, and he could see them when they were talking. The lighting on those things makes everyone look like they are dead, like zombies. I just left him to it, to his nonsense. What do you do on there all evening, I'd say. And he'd shrug and say, just talk to friends, nothing much. But he could spend hours doing whatever it was. Hours. Sometimes I'd wake up in the night, and he wouldn't be there, beside me in bed. I could hear the murmur of his voice from the spare room, but I knew better than to disturb him. He didn't welcome my company when he was on the computer. When I used to take him a cup of coffee, I had to knock before going in. He said I made him jump if I suddenly came into the room. So I'd knock, and he'd turn off the screen and take the cup off me. Thanks, he'd say. Anything interesting on the computer? I'd ask. No, he'd answer. Just the usual. End of conversation. I never used the computer. It was very much his department. But I think I always knew there was something going on in there. That's when I started calling it his nonsense. Meant I could talk about it out loud. He didn't like it being called that, but he couldn't really say anything, could he? It was such a harmless word. Nonsense. Something and nothing. But it wasn't nothing. It was filth. Things that no one should see, let alone pay to look at. Glenn told me it wasn't him when the police found it on his computer. They found stuff I didn't download, horrible stuff that just finds its way onto the hard drive when you're looking at something else, he said. I didn't know anything about the internet or hard drives. It could have happened, couldn't it? Loads of blokes are being wrongly accused, Jeannie, he said. It's in the papers every week. People steal credit cards and use them to buy this stuff. I didn't do it. I've told the police that. And when I didn't say anything, he went on. You don't know what it's like to be accused of something like this, when you haven't done anything. It tears you apart. I reached out and stroked his arm, and he grabbed my hand. Let's have a cup of tea, Jeannie, he said. And we went into the kitchen to put the kettle on. When I was getting the milk out of the fridge, I stood and looked at the photos on the door. Us on New Year's Eve, all poshed up. Us painting the ceiling in the front room, covered in spots of magnolia. Us on holiday. Us at the fair. Us. We were a team. Don't worry, you've got me, Jeannie, he'd say when I came home after a bad day or something. We're a team. And we were. There was too much at stake to split up. And we were in too deep for me to walk away. I'd lied for him. It wasn't the first time. It started with ringing up the bank to say he was ill when he didn't fancy going in. Then lying about losing the credit card when he said we'd got into financial trouble, so the bank would write off some of the withdrawals. It doesn't hurt anyone, Jeannie, he'd say. Go on, just this once. Of course, it wasn't. I expect that this is what Kate Waters wants to hear about. I hear her say my name in the hall, and when I get up to look, she's talking to someone on the phone, telling them to come and rescue us. Glenn used to call me his princess sometimes, but I'm sure no one is coming on a white horse to save me today. I go and sit down again and wait to see what happens.
Chapter 5. The Detective. Monday, October 2nd, 2006. Bob Sparks smiled the first time he heard Bella Elliott's name. His favourite auntie, one of his mum's flock of younger sisters, was called Bella, the joker in the pack. It was the last time he smiled for weeks. The 999 call had come in at 4:38. The woman's voice was breathless with grief. "She's been taken," she said. "She's only two. Someone has taken her." On the recording played over and over again in the ensuing days, the soothing alto tones of the male operator could be heard in an agonizing duet with the shrill soprano of the caller. "What is your little girl's name?" "Bella. She's called Bella." "And who am I talking to?" "I'm her mum, Dawn Elliott. She was in the garden at the front. Our house, 44A Manor Road, Westland. Please help me." "We will, Dawn. I know this is hard, but we need to know a few more things to help us find Bella. When did you last see her? Was she on her own in the garden?" "She was playing with a cat. On her own, after her nap. She hadn't been out there long. Just a few minutes. I went out to bring her in about 3:30, and she'd gone. We've looked everywhere. Please, help me find her." "Okay. Stay with me, Dawn. Can you describe Bella? What is she wearing?" "She's got blonde hair. In a ponytail today. She's only little. She's just a baby. I just can't remember what she was wearing. A T-shirt and trousers, I think. Oh, God, I can't think. She had her glasses on. Little round ones with pink frames. It's because she's got a lazy eye. Please, find her, please." It was 30 minutes later, after two uniforms from the Hampshire force had gone to confirm Dawn Elliott's story and make an immediate search of the house, that Bella's name came to D.I. Sparks's attention. "2-year-old gone missing, Bob," his sergeant said as he barged into the D.I.'s office. "Bella Elliott, not been seen for nearly 2 hours. In the front garden, playing, and then gone. It's a council estate on the edge of Southampton. Mum's in pieces and the doctor's with her now." Sergeant Ian Matthews laid a slim folder on his boss's desk. Bella Elliott's name was written in black marker on the cover and, attached with a paperclip, was a colour photo of a little girl. Sparks tapped the photo. taking it in before opening the file. What are we doing? Where are we looking? Where's the dad? Sergeant Matthews sat down heavily. The house, the loft, the garden so far. Doesn't look good. No sign of her. Dad is from the Midlands, the mum thinks. A brief encounter who left before Bella was born. We're trying to trace him, but the mum isn't helping. She says he doesn't need to know. And what about her? What's she like? What was she doing while her two-year-old was playing outside? Sparks asked. Said she was making Bella's tea. The kitchen looks out over the back garden, so she couldn't see her. Only a low wall at the front. Barely a wall at all. Bit careless to leave a child that age unsupervised, Sparks mused, trying to remember his two kids at the same age. James was now 30, an accountant of all things, and Samantha, 26, and newly engaged. Had he and Eileen ever left them in the garden as toddlers? He couldn't remember, to be honest. Probably wasn't around much at that stage, or was out at work. He'd ask Eileen when he got home, if he got home tonight. D.I. Sparks reached for his coat on a hook behind him and fished his car keys out of a pocket. I'd better get out there and have a look, Matthews. Sniff the air, talk to the mum. You stay here and get things organised in case we need an incident room. I'll call you before 7. In the car on the way to Westland, he turned on the radio to hear the local news. Bella was top of the news bulletin, but the reporter had found nothing that Sparks didn't already know. Thank goodness for that, he thought. His feelings toward the local media decidedly mixed. The last time a child had gone missing, things had turned ugly when the reporters started their own investigation and stomped all over the evidence. Laura Simpson, a 5-year-old from Gosport, had been found dirty, scared, and hidden in a cupboard at her step-uncle's place. It was one of those families where every Tom, Dick, and Harry was a relative, he'd told Eileen. Unfortunately, one of the reporters had removed the family album from the mother's flat, so the police hadn't seen a photo of Uncle Jim, a local registered sex offender, and realized his connection with the missing girl. He'd tried to have sex with a child, but failed, and Sparks believed he would have killed her as the detectives ran around in circles, sometimes only yards from her prison, if another member of the extended family hadn't got drunk and rung in with a name. Laura escaped with bruising to her body and mind. He could still see her eyes as he opened the door to the cupboard. Terror. No other word for it. Terror that he was going to be like Uncle Jim. He called a female detective forward to hold Laura in her arms, safe at last. Everyone had tears in their eyes, except Laura. She looked numb. He'd always thought he'd let her down somehow. Should have found the link earlier. Should have asked different questions. Should have found her quicker. His boss and the press had treated it like a triumph, but he couldn't celebrate. Not after he'd seen those eyes. Wonder where she is now, he thought. Wonder where Uncle Jim is now. Manor Road was filled with reporters, neighbours and police officers, each interviewing one another in a verbal orgy. Sparks pushed his way through the knot of people at the gate of number 44A, nodding at the journalists he recognised. Bob, a woman's voice called. Hi, any news, any leads? Kate Waters pushed forward and smiled mock wearily. He'd last seen her during a grisly murder investigation in the New Forest and had enjoyed a couple of drinks and a gossip in the weeks it took to nail the husband. They went way back, bumping into each other every so often on different cases and picking up where they'd left off. Not really a friendship, he thought. It was definitely all about work. But Kate was all right. Last time, She'd held onto a line in the story she'd stumbled on until he was ready for the information to come out. He owed her one. "Hello, Kate. Just got here, but may have something to say later," he said, ducking past the uniform guarding the house. There was a smell of cats and cigarettes in the front room. Dawn Elliott was huddled on a sofa, trembling fingers clutching a mobile phone and a doll. Her blonde hair was tethered off her face in a half-hearted ponytail, making her look even younger. She looked up at the tall, serious-looking man in the doorway, her face collapsing.
"Have you found her?"
she managed. "Miss Elliott, I'm Detective Inspector Bob Sparks. I'm here to help find Bella, and I want you to help me." Dawn looked at him.
"But I've told the police everything. What's the good of asking the same questions over and over? Just find her. Find my baby,"
she shouted hoarsely. He nodded and sat down beside her.
"Come on, Dawn. Let's go through it together," he said gently. "There may be something new you remember."
So she told him her tale, dry sobs choking off her words. Bella was Dawn Elliott's only child, the result of a doomed affair with a married man she'd met at a nightclub. A sweet little girl who loved watching Disney videos and dancing. Dawn didn't mix much with the neighbors.
"They look down their noses at me. I'm a single mum on benefits. They think I'm a scrounger," she told Bob Sparks.
But as they talked, his team and scores of volunteers from the community, many still in their work clothes, were searching back gardens, dustbins, hedges, attics, basements, sheds, cars, kennels, and compost heaps all over the neighborhood. The light was beginning to fade outside, and a voice suddenly cried out, "Bella! Bella! Where are you, lovey?" And Dawn Elliott jumped to her feet to look out the window.
"Dawn, come and sit down," Sparks said. "I want to ask if Bella has misbehaved today."
She shook her head.
"Have you been cross with her about anything?" he continued. "Little ones can be a bit of a trial, can't they? Did you have to smack her or anything?"
The intent behind the question slowly dawned on the young woman, and she shrieked her innocence.
"No, of course not. I never smack her. Well, not very often. Only when she acts up sometimes. I haven't hurt her. Someone's taken her."
Sparks patted her hand and asked the family liaison officer to make another cup of tea. A young constable put his head around the sitting room door and gestured to his senior officer that he needed a word.
"Someone saw a bloke wandering about the area earlier this afternoon," he told Sparks. "A neighbour saw him, didn't recognise him."
"Description?"
"A bloke on his own," he said. "Long hair, looked rough. Neighbour said he was looking in the cars."
Sparks fished his phone out of his pocket and called his sergeant.
"Looks like a live one," he said. "No sign of the child. We've got a description of a suspicious character walking down the road. Details on their way. Get it out there to the team. I'm going to talk to the witness. And let's knock on the door of every known sex offender in the area," he added, his gut churning at the thought of the child in the clutches of any of the 22 registered sex offenders honed by the local authority on the Westland housing estate. Hampshire Police Force had about 300 offenders in its area, a shifting population of flashers, voyeurs, paedophiles, and rapists who disguise themselves as friendly neighbours in unsuspecting communities. Across the road, at the window of his neat bungalow, Stan Spencer was waiting for the senior detective. Sparks had been told he'd started an ad hoc neighbourhood watch a few years back, when the spot in which he felt he was entitled to park his Volvo kept being usurped by commuters. Retirement held few activities for him and his wife Susan, apparently, and he relished the power a clipboard and nightly patrol gave him.
Spark shook his hand, and they sat together at the dining room table. The neighbour referred to his notes.
"These are contemporaneous, Inspector," he said,
and Spark suppressed a smile.
"I was watching out for Susan coming back from the shops after lunch, and I saw a man walking down our side of the road. He looked a rough sort, scruffy, you know, and I was worried he was going to break into one of the neighbour's vehicles or something. You have to be so careful. He was walking past Peter Treadwell's van."
Sparks raised his eyebrows.
"Sorry, Inspector. Mr. Treadwell is a plumber who lives down the road and has had his van broken into several times. I stopped the last one. So I went outside to keep watch on the man's activities, but he was quite far down the road. Unfortunately, I only saw the back of him. Long, dirty hair, jeans, and one of those black anorak things they wear. Then my phone rang indoors, and by the time I came back out, he'd gone."
Mr. Spencer looked very pleased with himself as Sparks noted it all down. "Did you see Bella when you went down your path?" Spencer hesitated, but shook his head.
"I didn't. I hadn't seen her for a few days. Lovely little thing."
5 minutes later, Sparks perched on a chair in Dawn Elliott's hallway and scribbled a press statement before going back to her sofa.
"Have you got any news?"
she asked.
"Nothing new at the moment, but I'm going to tell the media that we need their help to find her. And..."
"And what?"
Dawn said.
"And that we want to trace anyone who was in the area this afternoon."